netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from fxguide.com.
I'm addressing this letter to you because you and your films have been such an inspiration to so many who either watch or work in movies. That's the start of an open letter to Jim Cameron in the Huffington Post. Hi, I'm Mike Seymour of FX Guide, and welcome to this FX podcast. In a moment, Jeff Huser will sit down with the author of that open letter, Lee Stranahan, to discuss the contents of it, the cry for better working conditions and more recognition for visual effects artists. And this letter is interesting not only because it's becoming a bit of a lightning rod to attract people who agree with the sentiment, but also it's actually been quite polarizing. There have been other people who have strongly disagreed with it. As the guys will mention in the interview, Lee over at CG Society, for example, had some issues with it. In fact, a bit of a war broke out on the CG Talk over that. Now, Lee is actually an artist in the London market, which, you know, raises the question, is this something that is a purely Los Angeles-based problem? Does Lee Stranahan hit on an issue that's really just something that we're seeing in the Hollywood effects community, or is it really a global issue? Well, Jeff Huser sat down to discuss this and also the role that can be played and whether or not it's likely that this will lead to any concrete change in the working conditions or possibly the unionization of the VFX industry earlier this week. And we'll cross now to Jeff in Los Angeles.
Well, thanks, Lee, for joining us here on the FX Podcast. I think your article has probably been the most viral thing in the visual effects industry I've ever seen. I've gotten more emails and had more discussions with people about some of these things since your article came out. So how's the reaction been for you? What have you heard?
Well, I'll tell you, my reaction has really been the same. I'm on Twitter, right? So right. I have about like over 10,000 followers on Twitter, so a decent-sized Twitter following. And I've written about politics on the Huffington Post for a few years now. I've done a lot of political videos that have gone viral. I've ended up on CNN and MSNBC and stuff like that. So I've had stuff that's had an impact in the news world. That being said, the reason I mention that is this piece was retweeted more than anything I've ever done ever about anything, more than when my son was born, more than any news story. And I'd done news on the John Edwards story and stuff like that you'd think, well, that's pretty big. You know, everyone knows about the John Edwards story. This thing was retweeted about, I think, 250 times last I looked, which is an insane number of times.
Well, and Variety picked it up just recently. I saw there was an article from David Cohen, our friend over there at Variety.
Yeah, and that was amazing too. And really, you know, it's one of those things when I posted it, I told my wife, I said, I think this will have an impact. Well, I wasn't sure. You never know.
Yeah, right. Well, let's back up a little bit first. Let's talk about your background. Let's kind of let people know who you are and how you you know, what your background is and how you got to this point, and we'll talk about the article then right after that.
Sure. Well, I'm 44 now. I started doing video production work when I was 14 as an intern in San Francisco. And then this was, you know, a long time, so 30 years ago. And then about 20-something years ago, 20, 25 years ago, I had had a background in computers, like I'd owned a TRS-80, and I owned an Amiga, you know, that kind of thing. And then I also had this background in video. And then the two fields, which had never been together, merged about 25 years ago. So suddenly, if you knew a little about computers and a little bit about video, you were like a genius. Up till then, I was unemployable because I knew a little about computers and a little about video, but not enough either in either discipline to get hired, really. But suddenly, computer video, it's like I knew what I was doing. And so I formed the first users group for Lightwave 3D, and I formed the first it was connected with the Video Toaster product back then. And so I formed the first users group, and I started the first newsletter just sort of independently on my own because I thought these were going to be big, revolutionary products. And, you know, they were, really. And then due to that, I ended up doing stuff like I consulted on Jurassic Park. They were trying to figure out how to use some of this technology. My brother, Ken, who was like 21 at the time, he saw what I was doing in California, and he's like, what are you doing? Because he didn't understand the 3D graphic things at all. He knew I couldn't draw, and he could. My brother's a really fine artist, and my brother thought of me as like a writer, but that's what I moved to California for. But he was like, how are you doing these graphics? He didn't get the 3D thing at all. So he came out, and within about 6 months, he was working on Star Trek Next Generation in my living room, and then he got hired on Sequest. I went on to – the magazine got bigger sold out, and then I was doing a lot of writing and teaching people how to use Lightwave 3D and then how to do – you know, filmmaking and stuff like that. So I've been doing that for 25 years. I worked on a show called Space Above and Beyond in 95. That was my first real, I would say, professional visual effects experience. I went on to supervise and do other stuff. I've made a feature film. And then for about the past 5 years, five of the past 6 years, I left about a year ago. I was a motion graphics artist on the NBC show Access Hollywood. And, you know, in between there, I worked on projects for Fox and films and all sorts of stuff. So, but I also have this parallel life aside from the visual effects work, which I'm pretty realistic about my visual effects skills. I'm fine, but it's not what I'm passionate about. I really like writing and teaching. And so I'll do visual effects work periodically. And I know a lot about it. But it's not what I really like to spend every day all the time doing. And I compare it to music, where I own a guitar, but I don't consider myself a musician because I know musicians and I'm kind of a hack. So, but I still have fun and whatever. So the stuff that I really consider my passion is writing and teaching and helping other people pursue what they're interested in. And then my videos started to go viral. I started doing political videos about 3 years ago. And I got a tremendous amount of views and a lot of press there. And that led to a writing gig at the Huffington Post where I can write about whatever I want to write about. And periodically I will throw visual effects stuff in to the mix. I write comedy over there. I do a lot of political stuff. And then, punditry political stuff. Here's what I think will happen. Here's my opinion. And then I will throw visual effects stuff in. Like I did a video interview with Steve Preig from Benjamin Button before they were even nominated for the Oscar because I had a feeling that they'd win, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I interviewed him and put that up on Huffington Post, for instance. And so I try to throw this stuff in because, like I say, I know a lot about visual effects. I certainly know, especially if you compare me to most people who write about the subject in the mainstream press, you know, I'm like a total genius because
right.
I've actually got some experience there. Most people who write about it don't have any experience compared to actual visual effects geniuses. You know, I know some stuff, but I don't consider myself a killer there, but for the stuff that I do, the crossover stuff, I was able to interview Steve Preig and actually ask him intelligent questions. But then I have to figure out how to distill that into a form that anyone in the general public can understand. And so the background that I have kind of helps. So,
right, that's
so,
great.
So really I've kind of kept, you know, a foot. I produce a lot of stuff too, but I try to keep my feet in both worlds, explaining the stuff and doing the stuff.
All right. So what motivated you to take this angle with the open letter to James Cameron? I think it obviously has succeeded in terms of opening up the topic to a lot of people.
Well, I guess one of the things was that I made a real conscious decision earlier this year, and it's up on I have a blog at leestranahan.com. That's sort of my personal blog. And I made a conscious decision to kind of up my game in terms of the people I talk to and the subjects I write about. Like, I decided, you know, if I'm interested in interviewing somebody, I'll just ask them. I'm not going to be intimidated. It's really kind of, you know, I'm an independent sort of quasi-journalist. So, you know, it's not like I have a press credential or anything like that. I write about whatever I want to write about. But I made a conscious decision to kind of try to raise the the stakes of what I was writing about and talk about some bigger issues. And so there's a guy, Seth Godin, who's a best-selling author. He wrote Tribes and The Dip and a whole bunch of marketing books. And he's been an idol of mine forever. And I got an interview with him in January, and we just were talking about the state of the economy. And I came out with a product called How Much Should I Charge, which is a online training course in helping freelancers figure out what they should charge for things. Because I realized that's a real, you know, just talking to people and teaching, that's a real problem for people. They don't know what to charge. And in the economy that we're in right now, which is so weird, problematic is one way to look at it, but there's a lot of opportunities now too. I felt like, well, you know, this is a good topic to address. So I've been thinking, because of that product, I've been thinking a lot about pricing and the market and how people succeed in jobs and those sort of bigger, loftier issues, but try to make them practical. Like, okay, you know, here's what the economy is, but what should you do? And then I have a podcast about visual effects as well that I do, and I was sort of doing interviews with people. And one of the guys I talked to is Jeff Okun from the Visual Effects Society.
Sure.
And I'd been talking to him and doing interviews the past year. These business concerns would come up a lot in the interviews. What's the state of the visual effects industry today with the economy in meltdown, jobs moving overseas, everything else? And really the other big factor, of course, is that it's so easy to learn visual. The barriers to entry to getting into visual effects have never been lower. You can do it with any computer. You can get the demo software for free. You can go to a place like lynda.com for $25 a month and learn as much as you can learn, not to kiss up to you guys, but effects PhD, amazing. It's absolutely amazing what you can learn at effects PhD for basically no money. I mean, basically a completely affordable rate. Back when I started doing this 20 years ago, you needed a $6,000 computer. You had to spend $3,000 in the software at minimum. And not many people knew how to do it or could get the money together or would spend the time. Nowadays, anybody could sit down and learn stuff. So that's really had an effect, too, on things. So I was thinking about all these issues. And then it just kind of hit me, because one of the things about trying to play a bigger game, like I'm talking about, is you start to look at yourself differently and you start to go, you know, I have these opportunities, but opportunities are kind of obligations, really. Like if I have the ability to, if I have the platform of the Huffington Post, which is one of the most read and linked to websites in the entire world, and I can write about anything I want to, I should probably write about stuff that's important and not just minutiae or not just complaining about stuff. And I realized that I was in a unique position to talk about this issue that nobody talks about the really grossly unfair treatment of visual effects artists. And when I say grossly unfair, I don't mean compared to sweatshop workers in Asia, which have their own issues.
Yeah, I saw some people commenting like that in some of the forums. We'll talk about that, yeah.
And that's obviously worse, but, you know, here's what I feel like. That's covered. Like I don't know how else to put it, but, like, there are people reporting about that, and they should be. And I'm not taking up a collection for visual effects artists. We're not at that point yet. And I don't even think it's to the point of signing a petition. However, compared to other people in the visual effects in the film industry, if you go to a film set, every person on the film set, including the people who drive the crew back and forth between the hotel, they all get fringe benefits. They all get meal penalties. They all get overtime.
Right. There's definitions of what they get.
And exactly
right. Effects, there's no definitions other than what the state not only defines but enforces, or wherever. I'm not referring to any specific. I'm saying wherever you happen to be located. It's a question of what's defined, and then also the bigger problem really is enforcement.
And we can talk about that, because I think there's a reason that things have developed the way that they have. I don't think it's a grand conspiracy to screw anybody. I think it's that the industry is 20 years old, kind of. The digital side of it's only 20 years old. And there's another reason we can talk about if you're interested in a minute. But once I realized that, like, I can write about anything I want at Huffington Post. So I'm like, you know, I should write about this. And I tried to figure out a way to make it accessible to a wider audience. And I came up with the idea of doing an open letter to Cameron because he's in the news so much. And also because in one of my interviews with Jeff Okun, he talked about how James Cameron was a matte painter. He worked in visual effects. So he's got that background. And I'm like, well, you know what? And I have some connections to Cameron. My first wife's brother is a Titanic artist who worked with Cameron. And my son's been in Ghost of the Abyss, which was a film Cameron made. So I have some connections there. And I knew a lot of people who worked on Titanic as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, you know, that's a good handle. And once I came up with a handle, I just wrote the piece pretty quickly because it's something I know a bit about. And then just sort of send it out to the world and got an amazing reaction from it right away, which tells me something. The reaction from most people was, thank God someone's talking about this. And I got a letter today. It's not just visual effects artists. This is the thing people need to realize. It's not just visual effects artists. I got an article, a letter from a wife of a visual effects artist. I have gotten three or four letters at least by people who said, one guy works at a major, well-known visual effects. If I name the company, he asked me not to. If I name the company, everyone knows who they are. And he said, I've lost three girlfriends, three fiancés because of my job. I work so much that these are women who I wanted to marry, who I loved, who I wanted to marry, who my relationship ended because I was never there. And I got a letter from a wife today whose husband works in visual effects, who said, thank God you're doing this. Thank God you're writing about this. People do not realize how bad this is. And so, I mean, this is something that I know personally is a real human, these are human beings. There's a human impact. And we can talk about the forums because one of the things that has been very interesting to me is some people really want to treat this issue I've got a couple comments on my blog, like, well, I'm not entitled to anything. I know the deal working in visual effects. And they're defending the current system, which is indefensible. And I had one guy who said, well, this is a sense of entitlement. Visual effects people aren't artists. And
yeah.
I said, what? And he was like, and he was getting, now here's the thing. There's a punchline to this story. So I said, well, you know, a definition of an artist is you're making creative choices. It's commercial art. So it's not like you're sitting there coming up with every aspect of the project, but it is art and you are making creative choices. And he's like, nope, I just paint images that go into a shader. He's like, nothing creative about it. I'm not an artist. And if I can take it or leave it. One person in comments said, if the whole industry moves to China, that's okay by me.
Yeah, I have to say, I went through the comments on your blog. I went through the comments on Huffington Post. I went through the comments, a couple other forums, some that have even been closed. And I've even heard mention that you've been banned from some forums. So, I mean, I think there's been an amazing reaction in a lot of different directions, some of which really surprised me. Some of the comments you're talking about there just really took me by surprise. It's much like trying to defend the healthcare system in the United States right now.
It's like trying to defend the healthcare system if you have cancer and the insurance company's actively denying you.
Right. No, I mean, exactly. No, I know. No, I mean, I was going to say, you pointed out a bunch of really, good things. And we've been, I mean, at FX Guide, we've been really trying to bring in a forefront to this issue of the treatment of artists. And it's been difficult. And also, frankly, you know, if we add all of our podcasts together, I'm sure that the people that have read the Huffington Post article, you know, is a way bigger number. You're on the mainstream, the quote-unquote mainstream part of the media there. So, you know, I'm really thankful for you for, you know, launching it into this other area that we've just not been able to break through. I mean, there's a lot. If people want to go and look back through a lot of the podcasts, we've done quite a bit on this subject and talked to people at the guilds. The last podcast we just did was with the Animation Guild with Steve Hewlett. And we've been really trying to do this, but you've really shined. This is the thing. You've really lit up the issue in a very big way.
Well, that's what I was trying to indicate before. I mean, the thing is, I could. In other words, because I have that access to HuffPost, I realized that I could. And once I realized I could, I realized I kind of had an obligation to do so. I'll mention specifically because the punchline was, did you see the CG Talk forums? Is that what you were?
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah. Now, I had no idea that Lee over there was the guy. This shows how ignorant I am. Because I stay off of forums in general because for anything I'm interested in, I stay off of forums in general because I think there's a certain nastiness that goes along in my experience with forums about any topic. The topic could be cute bunnies, and eventually one guy runs the cute bunny forum and some chick posts and he doesn't like her, and then this gal posts and blah, blah, then it's a mess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree.
And so I just stay off of those things. So I've been a member of CG Channel or CG Talk since 2003, and apparently I am banned over there suddenly, which is weird to me. I don't think it's related to this, but what I know is I can't type anymore over there. I don't want to be cryptic. I posted something about classes that I do in an area that I thought was where you posted about classes.
Oh, a promotion type thing. They took it as, I guess.
Right. It was a promotion type thing. What I would have done is I would have said, but it wasn't subtle. It was blatant promotion in an area about online schools, and I have one. So it was so blatant that I would have gone, well, he's clearly just doesn't know the rules here. So I just would have said, hey, we don't do that here, and please don't do that again, and then you move on from there. You know what I'm saying?
Like, no, that's, I know. No, we've run into that with, us having a training site. We've run into that sometimes with people not wanting, you know, us to mention anything about it. And, you know, it's rare, but it does happen. So,
and this was specifically, I didn't mention it in the thread. It was completely separate. It was just, it was in a thread on schools. I posted something about my school. Okay. I thought that's where you were supposed to post it. So, apparently not. But anyway, yeah, they ended up closing that thread down. And that really bugged me. Because I didn't get why so many people were defending the dude saying, I'm not an artist. But then I realized that he runs the forum. I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah. I'm like, of course they defend him. He runs the forum. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's so – I mean, one of the things I've hit on a lot in all the work I've been doing, the visual effects podcast, my teaching, is this idea of telling people, look, you're an artist. Market yourself as an artist. If you treat yourself like a commodity, you're going to be priced like a commodity. This comes up if I'm talking to web designers or motion graphics artists. Doesn't make any difference. Don't price yourself like a commodity. And here's a guy who's in a position of power doing kind of the opposite of what I think is good. If I did what I thought was right and in putting this article out there, this guy's doing sort of – and I don't think he means badly – but, man, it's like, dude, you're hurting the whole industry. And if you don't think you're an artist, oh, keep it to yourself. And maybe you – good. Don't get the protections that everyone else has.
Right.
But I know people who are artists, and they make creative decisions all the time. And so if you don't, fine. Let's exclude you from inclusion in the benefits. But other people want and deserve them. And that really did bug me because I'm like – I mean – when I say bug me, I mean I was depressed for a day. I was literally – I told my wife that night. I'm like, I feel sad for humanity. I said, because it's like when people look up to somebody because they were on a forum or something. I'll put it like this, Jeff. It would be like if you were using the position you're in against visual effects artists. How depressing would that be?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a big fan of Effects Guide and all the stuff you guys are doing. It makes sense to try to lift the profession up, not put it down. So
no, right? No, I mean, you know, we try to not stomp on our forums, and you know, but I will shut down personal attacks and things like that. But other than that, and obscenities of it, you know, not obscenities, but you know, porn and stuff like that. But you know, we. Other than personal attacks, we tend to let people go for the most part. But you know, whatever. I mean, we've run in that. It's when you own the bully pulpit, I guess you can do what you want. But you know, people aren't dumb to that though. People see what's going on.
Right. And that's why, like, on my own website and on Huffington Post, where I have moderation control on my own things on Huffington Post, if people say something negative or disagreeing with me on a point, I'll post it. Doesn't make any difference to me. If it's just personal attacks, I don't post that. Right. But if it's just like I don't agree with this or that, and the other thing that happened in the CG Talk forum is somebody posted something about, well, Lee, you're in no position to talk because you canceled a training tour, and I would have loved to have answered that because, and then that's when they shut the forum down, and it's like, well, I can't even answer it, and I can't even figure out how to contact the guy. If there's a customer, you know, it's like if someone said, well, I'm unhappy with something FXPHD did, you ripped me off, you'd want to deal with them, you know, right, you'd exactly. want to go like, oh, okay, well, let me handle this customer service issue. But that has nothing to do with me writing about this. And so it's like that's what they did. They sort of ended it on a personal attack against me that I have no way of even responding to or helping the person. And that's sad. That's right. That's what's frustrating.
Let's kind of look at the article a little bit and a couple of the points. I mean, because I think it's good to just kind of go through and clarify some stuff because there's been a lot of spin like this in these forums and the comments and things like that. I mean, you start off talking about the unfair treatment and working conditions of visual effects artists around the world. And I think we all have a pretty good understanding about that. I mean, we've all heard stories about people, you know, the 100-hour weeks and, you know, and again, I mean, you know what? That happens at the end of a movie a lot of times. It's a question of how are people being compensated for that time and is that proper? And, you know, like you said, on a film shoot, everybody that's on that set, you know, there's meal breaks and there's, you know, turnaround time. And I mean, they have their own problems. I mean, there's a website 12 on 12 off where there's a bunch of production people trying to focus on the issue of turnaround and getting proper time between shoot days and things. And following up on that, the guy who died driving home from the set.
Yes.
There's a documentary there and things. So, I mean, it's not a totally insulated world. They do have their problems. But, you know, at least on a film set, there are definitions of all that stuff. Whereas in visual effects, there's no definitions.
Right.
So, obviously, that's a big one. And things like no contracts, that's becoming a big issue as more companies. I mean, I think I read somewhere today, some article today, that 2/3 of the artists in visual effects are freelance. Now, I don't remember where I saw that. I'll find the link for that and put it in the story. I think it was in Motionographer today.
Motionographer is doing a good job of trying to cover these issues too. Bran over there is trying to write about this stuff.
Yeah, and there's this other thing that's going on now with the company that's acting as a billing agent for people now that companies are forcing people to use and taking a percentage to not have artists be an independent contractor. That's a whole subject they've been doing a good job with covering.
Yes.
The things just keep rolling here. The way things keep getting, you know, twisted and turned. No vacation time, no benefits. And like you said, no paid overtime. So, I mean, these are the issues we're focused on. We're not focused necessarily on, you know, I don't know. I mean, people in these forums just sometimes they just go off on these tangents. And I'm like, what are you talking about? These are the core issues here.
Well, and this is the thing. Look, here's the way this developed, okay? Let's say you're a director, a film director today, right? Here, this was probably your career path or you know, there's a million variants on it. But you're a director or you're a director of photography, let's say. You probably started as a PA on a film set. Then you worked your way up to, like, gaffer or something like that. Then you maybe got onto the camera crew, you start off as a second AC, you go to a first AC, now you're director of photography, okay? So it's taken you X number of years, you know, a year, 10 years, whatever it is. But you had experience on sets, and at every point after being a PA, maybe you were an unpaid PA, maybe you didn't get paid for that, maybe you got meals and not much else. But after that, you started getting paid, and you were dealing with unions, and you were dealing with fringe benefits, you were dealing with protections, okay? That's mm-hmm. everybody who works on a film set. They came up, and they're used to that. Now, contrast that to people who work in visual effects, because I know this firsthand from when my brother came out. How did you start in the industry? You started in a room with a computer. You were never on a set. You follow me?
Yep.
Your next job, you're in a room on a computer. Then the next job, you're in a room on a computer. Maybe you work your way up to set supervisor, which means they send you to the set, usually blind and with no training whatsoever. But you know how visual effects are done. They send you out to the set. You show up for a day or two. You're not really part of the crew. And if you've done supervision, you know what I mean, Jeff, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
You're not exactly part of the crew. You kind of are, but you're kind of like a visitor to the set. And then you go back and you're in the room in a computer. And so what I'm saying is, a lot of these people in the forums, and I don't mean this in a negative, insulting way, I mean it factually, they are ignorant. They literally have no idea what it's like on a real film set, except what they've seen in DVD special editions. But they never worked there. So they think it's, if you want fringe benefits and if you want all those things, you're acting like entitled was one word that's come up a lot. You're acting like you're entitled. And I'm saying, no, it's exactly what every other person on that set gets, including the people who drive the transpo people who get fringes paid in and have meal penalties and all these other things we're talking about. So the only people who don't get them, and by the way, let's be clear here, the producers have a guild too. So this is not like I didn't make up this concept of having guilds and unions to offer protections for workers. This has been around since the inception of the industry.
Yep. Well, and I've been trying to get a hold of – there's one guy I'm trying to get for a podcast, and hopefully I'll get him. But I'm trying to get him because he wasn't on a panel I went to see. He was in the audience at a panel I went to see, and the subject of the guild came up, of one of the guilds. And he got up and gave this just impassioned speech about the fact and told his story about starting in the industry. And I can't do it justice, but in a nutshell, he was talking about how he didn't set out to join the guild. He just ended up in the guild because he had to do the jobs. You know, he grew into it. And, you know, he woke up 20 years later going, wait, I have had health care all this time. I've got a 401k. I've been able to borrow money for a house and, you know, set my family up. And, you know, this is the stuff that people I'm worried about in the visual effects industry, you know, are not being able to. You know, it is a very difficult industry on relationships. It's a very difficult industry on, and more and more so financially. And people not paying attention to things like healthcare and 401ks and retirement. It's hard when I'm in your 20s, like we talked about in the Steve Hewlett podcast. People don't think about those things, but you know that's what having those kind of protections means to people in the long term. Is having those available is more of an automatic thing.
And no, exactly right. And I know it just because all my friends are visual. You know, most of my friends in LA are visual effects artists. They're people who. When I was doing this 20 years ago, guys like a guy like John Gross, who runs Eden Effects, when he first moved to California, he lived at my house, or my brother lived at my house. A lot of people ended up living at my house when they first moved out. And so I knew all these people when they were 21, 23-year-old people just getting into the industry. And at the point, you were so excited to be working in TV or films that, you know, my brother went from being a museum guard in Springfield, Massachusetts, to like within 8 months working on Star Trek with no background, no diploma. He's a high school dropout, but he's just a really talented artist who's very smart and took the time to learn this stuff. So people were so happy to be working on it. But now my brother's 40 and he's got 2 kids and a wife. And I'll be honest, you know, if God forbid he got divorced, let's say, he's got nothing. He's got absolutely nothing for retirement. Everything he's doing, his wife works for the airlines. All his future plans are based on staying married, let's say. And I know a lot of people in that position. They do the visual effects work, and their wife has to work or something like that in order to get benefits that might sustain them or get health care or something like that. That's a really bad position to be in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I had an emotional reaction when I went to visit Steve Hewlett at the Animation Guild. I was in the lobby waiting for him to come out, and there was a collection of pamphlets, and it was all for the benefits that were available to members. And I just got sick looking at this going, whoa, how come this doesn't exist for anybody else? You know, how come we don't have this?
Yeah, no, it's – well, you know, here's the other thing too. You know, when I worked at Access Hollywood, I was in the Art Directors Guild. I was in a union. and I have money in a 401k, right? I left there a year ago. They helped me leave. They helped me get severance when I left, and I left voluntarily for medical reasons. So imagine if you're – and look, my medical reasons are like tendonitis. I have really bad tendonitis in my right hand, stabbing pain that a lot of people out there might identify with in my arm, lower arm and elbow. And just because I was at NBC, for instance, I had access to workman's comp help where I was getting medical treatment and massages and stuff like that, you know, therapeutic massages free. Am I the only person who's worked in visual effects who's had tendonitis? I don't think so.
No, not at all.
But where's the medical help for that? And it was all part of it. I have money in a 401k now that I can cash out or keep or whatever, but it's thousands and thousands of dollars just from the time I was at NBC. And, you know, I got an interesting letter from a guy today because I teach. I have a class called the Dream Career Workshop, which is – well, look, let me back up for a second because you teach too, right, Jeff?
Yes.
So here's the thing. You know that we have, like I said, I'm going to use the word obligation again. If I'm going to tell people, hey, you should get into this industry, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what we're doing when we teach. Hey, come on, get into this industry. It's great. And you and I both know it's great. I love visual effects. It's a great field. However, there are real problems. And I guess I feel like we have, and that's why I appreciate the work you guys are doing. There's a lot of people who I think would unethically say to people, hi, come work in visual effects, it's great, would take their money for training and then not tell them they're sending them into a boiler room that where they're not going to get the same treatment as other people who work in film. I don't think that's right. And so part of this is, as somebody who teaches and is encouraging people to get into the field, I also have to be realistic about it. Now, on an individual basis, like if someone came to me and said, well, what should I do individually? I have a different answer than the collective answer. In other words, what I don't think anybody listening should do on an individual basis is sit around and hope that they get medical, benefits, because that won't help. I think you should work for it. But individually, I think what you should do is differentiate yourself, make yourself not a commodity, learn how to market yourself, learn how to use social media tools. And that's what I teach people in my career training thing, my dream career thing. And I got a letter from a guy today who's like, well, how are the unions, how's that going to help? And I'm like, literally what's going on in a lot of cases is illegal. It's literally what some of these people are doing. And the case of Dave Rand and the guys in Meteor up in Canada prove this, but I know plenty of cases. What they're doing is actually illegal. There are labor laws in the country, and the independent contractor thing you mentioned, it's not legal to treat someone as an employee but pay them as an independent contractor. But how often does that happen? And the answer is all the time. And so my advice for people individually is work on your craft, learn to market yourself.
Absolutely.
But collectively, you can do both. You can say, like, in other words, I think one of the best things people could do is make their own movies. And I encourage people to do that, and I try to help people do that, and I try to teach people how to do that. That being said, there's no reason you can't be working on your own movie and still get fair treatment at your day job. No reason whatsoever. And a lot of people are treating it like either or. And if you read the forums, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Sure.
A lot of people are like, oh, well, no, if you really want to do it, take control of your own destiny and make your own movie. Yes, I agree. Yes, do that.
And part of the reasons that worker protections and overtime laws were instituted in the, as they came to be, was to protect from the 100-hour week. Because the likelihood is, if the company's paying you, double time after 12 hours, they're probably not going to want you to be there for 36. It's just practical, It's going to cost them a lot more money, and it's supposed to discourage those type of abuses. That's the whole idea. So when people work for flats and when people work against the labor laws that they're governed by in their local area, it just hurts everybody.
Well, the other thing that bugs me too is people. A couple people were like, yeah, and I see people on Craigslist trying to get people to work for free, and that's the whole problem. People shouldn't work for free. And I'm just like, dude, that's not the problem. Mm. Because here's the thing, Jeff. I mean, I've been in positions where I've been trying to make my own film, let's say, right? And I might call you and go, hey, I'm doing this project, blah, 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 blah. Could you come out and give me a hand because I'm trying to do this? There's no money. Sorry. But here's the thing. I'm not making any money. I'm not making $100 million.
Right.
I'm trying to get a project going. And when I see people like downing people, you know, here's the thing. ILM isn't looking for people on Craigslist, or DD's not looking for people on Craigslist.
Right.
Those are minor projects.
Right. And frankly, you know, I mean, if somebody wants to get experience and they're willing to do something for free and they want to do that to help somebody out doing a film. We have posts in our forums all the time from people working on films, looking for people to do a few shots here and there, you know, for their personal projects. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that. Like you say, it's a profit-making venture servicing a profit machine that we're the littlest cog without any voice is what bothers me.
Except we're not the littlest cog, because I agree with you completely. And the way you phrased it is great. It is a profit-making machine. Except now, and I use G.I. Joe as an example, that film, people did not go to watch that film because they wanted to see the acting. That film is thrill ride start to finish.
Mm-hmm. There's several of those, yes.
And there are visual effects shots in literally every single shot of that film. And so what I feel like is I feel like every visual effects artist deserves the same rights as everybody else who works in the film industry that involves fringes. And I think there should be a system where on a film that every single shot is a visual effects shot, a guy like Eric Barba or John Knoll, the effects supervisor, deserves some kind of royalty in the same way that a composer or whoever will get it. I don't think that's for every film, and I don't think it's for every – I think it's unreasonable to expect every person on it. But here's the thing. Now you've got an incentive for a Jeff Okun or a John Knoll to stay in the industry. And if I'm a guy lower than them, I have a reason to move up to that position in the industry. So that's one of sort of my – I haven't mentioned this before. But that's one of my –
That's a good one. You had mentioned something about residuals in the article, and I was kind of giving that some thought because when I first read it, I was like, really? And I was thinking that, you know, if you think about films, you think this has to be a conversation that comes up with Pixar and Stan Winston and Henson and, you know, I mean, you got to think this Dave Fluff Marshmallow character, you know – whoever rigged that years ago had to be thinking, you know, wait a minute, I'm creating a key character in this movie that's going to be made into toys for the next generation. You know, I'm sure this conversation has been had over and over again for years and years and years in rooms like that. I'm glad you explained that because I was curious what you meant by that.
Well, there's two ways you can look at the residuals. One is there are residuals that get paid out to benefits, for instance, for gaffers. If you're a gaffer, do you get residuals? Kind of. Because as the film goes forward, money gets paid and money's made. Money gets paid into the union for benefits. Does that make sense?
That's interesting, yes.
So there's one way of looking at residuals. Now, that doesn't mean that the individual gaffer gets a check from whatever, but they're still getting benefits from it. But the other way that I've thought of is that I do think that, and I think it's pretty easy to break down. Look, every single film right now uses visual effects to some degree or another. I think if you're doing a small character-driven piece and there's five where you're doing like cloud, you know, rig removal or sky replacement, mm-hmm. let's say, I don't think that's not residual worthy. But a film like G.I. Joe, for instance, and I mentioned that because I talked to the guys from DD, my brother worked on it. I mean, that film, the only reason that film exists is because of the visual effects, period, the end. That's the only reason it exists. And really, I'll put it like this. You know, I mean, in the 50s, there were Westerns. There were a lot of Westerns. It's a genre of films. People are going to look back at this period of time and go, oh, there were visual effects films. it was a genre of films. And we kind of thought they were like adventure films or action films, but really, or sci-fi films, but really some of them were just visual effects films. They were just, you know, in the 50s, if you put a guy in a horse and a hat, you got a movie. And there were good films and bad films, but not everyone was John Ford back then, but it's the same thing today. And so you see a film like G.I. Joe, which is really just a big visual effects demo reel with some amazing work, with some really, really amazing work in there. Having talked to the guys from DD, when they explained some of the stuff they did, like there's an entire sequence where the building's virtual that I do visual effects for a living. I had no clue that the glass building was all virtual. None. It wouldn't have occurred to me that you would do that all virtual. Right. But they did it, and they pulled it off. That they're doing top flight work there, and they don't get anything 20 years from now, and Shia LaBeouf does for Transformers. That's crazy.
Yep, it is definitely a discussion that needs to be had. It's a much bigger issue, but that's not an easy one to solve, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I mean, I think – you know, really the whole purpose of the letter, and it's worked, I guess, is to start a discussion. And, man, I guess it's, you know, from what you're saying and from what other people, from what I've seen personally, it's done that. It's gotten people discussing things.
Right.
Now I think the next question is, where do you go from here? What do you do about it? One of the things I'm in the active planning stages on, and I'd like to enlist your help in this too, actually, is doing a virtual online town hall meeting for visual effects people to talk about some of this stuff and to sort of bring in a rep from the union, bring in some people to talk about stuff so people at least get the concept. I think that, you know, what I'd like to see happen out of this is people start having a discussion at lunch, you know, people talking about this outside of the workplace. It's really a tough conversation to have in the workplace. There's a lot of pressures there. But ultimately, I don't care whatever people want to decide individually. One of the reasons I was able to write this, honestly, is I don't have a dog in this hunt. I don't work actively in visual effects. Because of my tendonitis, I don't plan to. I might supervise and I teach, but I don't care. You know, it's like I'm not going to be working those 100-hour weeks, period. That's not me. But that puts me in a unique position to talk about this stuff because I don't care. I don't really have a vested interest one way or another. It's just something I know about.
Right.
And
well, we appreciate it. I mean, I think that as we look back, as this conversation starts getting bigger and bigger, there's a couple of – I think that your letter – is going to be marked in the timeline with a big red mark as a big event. Just like I think the David Rand and the guys from Journey to the Center of the Earth. I think that all of their suffering and all of their not getting paid and all that waiting to get the partial payment that they got. I mean, I think that that was the beginning of this whole conversation for a lot of us.
Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. Here's the important thing. It was Dave Rand talking about it because I've known, as I'm sure you have, I've known people who've been screwed before. Now, that case up in Canada was particularly heinous, I will say that. Mm-hmm. But, I've been involved in lawsuits in this business, and it was pretty heinous, but I was involved in a lawsuit over something that was pretty equally heinous. And the difference is, but I'll say this, like, here's the reason I'm being a little cagey in the lawsuit. I can't talk about it. The lawsuit was settled, and part of the settlement was that I can't discuss it. So this is what happens. I just want people to know this is what happens in these deals where a lot of times people may get through the court process. They may even win. Then they're not allowed to talk about it anymore. And the thing that Dave did was great was he talked about it. He wouldn't shut up about it. He would not just lay down and move on to the next project and lesson learned. That was criminal, you know. I mean, it's one thing if I take on a project, I'm trying to make a film and I run out of money and I can't pay people and then we abandon the project. That's one thing. That happens, right? It's one thing if you get in a situation you owe people money. Up in Meteor, they made a conscious decision. They were going to keep people working, not pay them, and then shut them out as soon as the shots were done. That's criminal. I don't know how else to put it. Yeah. That's criminal. That's making a decision to screw somebody financially, to keep them working under false pretenses. It's fraudulent and it's wrong. And the great thing was Dave kept talking about it. Now, a lot of people, I mean, they ended up settling for 70 cents on the dollar. And Dave told me he voted against that because I understand that too. Like Dave was the guy who's like, I'm going to keep talking about it. But Dave was really one of the only people who talked about it.
He's
up
certainly
there.
The only name I can put with the whole fight and the whole discussion.
That's right. And people are so, there's this built-in thing that they want to defend. And I think it's a benevolent thing on people's part. They don't want to think the worst of people. But, you know, come on, man. I mean,
yeah, that was pretty clear cut.
Right. At a certain point, it's just like, come on, please. You're getting screwed here. You don't have to be a victim about it. But, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to say. When I've looked back on some of the labor union things over the years, you know, I mean, there's no question that if visual effects people decided they wanted to have a guild, it's not going to be a bloodless fight. It's got to be a fight. People have to stand up. And people would have to want it bad enough to risk losing a job over it. That's what it takes. You don't just magically snap your fingers and, oh, I'm on a union now. That doesn't happen. But the thing that is so different right now versus you think back to the textile workers and things like that, there was no internet, you know? I mean, there's no way that people could share right. information instantly and rapidly and accurately and, you know, document things. And I mean, this is a whole new world, and I'm shocked that the guilds haven't just gone web, you know, crazy on – you try to find information about a guild. To everybody out there, go try to find out what it means to join a guild. What's the difference between a union and a guild? Go try to find that information on any of the labor websites that serve our industry.
Well, the other factor, everything you're saying is true. The other factor is you can do it anonymously. This is why I want to do this
exactly.
online town hall.
Exactly.
The reason I can do an online town hall, and I'm going to do it at night. I'm going to do it so it starts at about 7 o'clock West Coast time, 10 o'clock East Coast time. You know, I don't know. I don't have all the details worked out yet, but
sure.
I can tell you that detail. It's not going to be during the day, and hopefully people will be able to download it whenever they want to and listen if they can't attend. Here's the thing. I want people to be able to show up, listen, ask questions, and do it anonymously.
Yep.
Because otherwise, I think a lot of people would be afraid to speak up.
Sure. Well, I also think that the big thing, the key is going to be getting some experts there, because I've been asked to be involved with other forums in the past that had excluded guilds, for example, and not, you know, I mean, I really would love, and I've been trying to get this for podcasts, but this would even be a better place for it. Get a labor lawyer who understands this stuff involved with something like this. You know, we need some experts involved in this. Maybe it's too early for that, but we just need some people to explain what people's rights are and what the real deals are.
Well, you and I should talk afterward, Jeff, because I would really, when I said I am enlisting your help, that's not BS. I mean, I'm just a guy, you know, I really am. I'm just a dude.
I'm with you.
In my bedroom trying to pull this stuff together. And I'm sure you know people who I don't know and have suggestions. And I completely want that, because the thing I realized was when I was getting all these letters was like, it's that obligation thing. I know how to put together a webinar. I know technically how to do it. I can do it. It doesn't really have to cost very much money. And it can reach a huge number of people. Therefore, am I just talking here? Did I just write an article and, oh, good, the article's done, then I can move on with things? Or am I serious about this? And I'm serious about this. But, you know, I'm serious about this. A couple people were like, well, gee, Lee, why don't you step up and do something about it then? And at first my reaction was, I don't know what to do. And that wasn't a BS reaction. It was literally like, I didn't write this letter as part of a big agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And my agenda now is not to unionize people. In other words, I don't know if that's the right answer.
No, I agree.
But you know what? The more I think about it, the more I think it might be. And I think what people need to do is get in a forum, and Steve from the Animation Guild is the perfect guy to do this because he's no lilting flower, as you know.
Yes.
I want people to be able to go to this. The reason I'm calling it a town hall is I want people to be able to stand up and say to Steve, you know what? I was in a union when I worked in construction. I hated it. They made me do this and that and this. And tell me how my life as an animator won't suck if I'm in your guild. And I want Steve, I want to hear that answer, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
And
absolutely. Well, and I have to say, you know, sitting around wishing this wasn't this way is not doing anybody any good. That's what we've been doing for 25 years as we've built this business. And it's time to have professional conversations with professional people who understand how to make these things happen and how to address these problems instead of just talking about them. So I'm, right. You know, I'm happy to help whatever I can do, you know, to spread the word about this and get people to be involved. And we'll talk afterward about that further.
Yeah, I you know, people say that stuff all the time. Oh, I like you, blah, blah, blah. I really mean it. I mean, the thing is, and anybody who wants to get involved can just contact me or contact Jeff or contact someone. I mean, the thing is, this is really about discussions, and we're not helped by – well, here's one of the things. You know, everybody – this is a very human thing. Everybody thinks that their problems are their problems. In other words, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you got payday loans out because you're trying to balance things, you feel – again, I've been in that position. When I was working at NBC, I was paycheck to paycheck and I had five payday loans at some points working that job because they cut all our overtime. I lost about $30,000 a year overnight basically, but I didn't know it until the year had ended up. And so suddenly I'm doing this. Well, what happens is – it's humiliating. And so no one wants to talk about that stuff.
Sure. And how many people have dipped into their 401k or their savings of any sort or maxed out their credit cards? I mean, this is exactly what's happening.
And so what happens is if you just keep that stuff to yourself because you feel like a loser, which you do, you know, mm-hmm. going to the payday loan pace, you don't feel like a winner. But then afterwards I thought about it. I'm like, gee, there's a lot of these payday loan places. Maybe I'm not the only person
yeah.
who's a loser here.
Well, there's burrito stores next door and, you know, there's a whole industry right around it. So
that's exactly right. And once you realize that, you're like, you know what? Once you start talking to people, I guess it's like – it's what they say about, you know, if you're an abused wife or something like that. Once you start talking about it, you realize there's a lot of abused wives or whatever, right?
Yep.
So once you start talking about these issues of the 100-hour work week and the relationship problems, suddenly you realize, oh, my God – this isn't me. It's not that – because here's the other pressure that happens in VFX. It's this macho thing because also it's so – look, let's face it. The visual effects world is so male-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It's not close. It's like 90-10 or something in my experience. So yep. That leads to a certain amount of macho stuff. Like if you can't handle the 100-hour weeks, you're a wussy. And you know what? At a certain point, people should realize, no, it's not your wussy. Human beings weren't meant to work 100-hour period. That's not that's not how we were built. And that's the thing I want is discussions. If people start looking at this and going, you know what? Yeah, you know what? My marriage almost ended because I was working so much. Or, yeah, my arm hurts all the time and I don't know what to do about it. Or, look, I had a friend who attempted suicide earlier this year. Who's a visual effects artist with 24 years of experience, who literally attempted suicide because he had health problems that he thought were going to kill him. And he had no health insurance, and yet he's going down to Venice every day, right? That's unconscionable. And it's unconscionable. And this is a guy, you know, I mean, and it's not unusual.
No.
It's... you know, maybe that extreme, and maybe me hearing about the suicide attempt was unusual. Maybe that's the part that's weird. Maybe it happens and we don't know about it. But, you know, and luckily, you know, this friend of mine's pulled through and stuff like that. But I got to tell you, I don't think it's his fault. I think there's a systemic problem here. And the quicker people realize that the system is causing the problems that they're having in their lives, the quicker we can actually solve the problem. And I'll tell you, I think we need to solve it because – and Jeff, tell me this is your experience too because you talk to a lot. I interview people for the podcast. I know so many effects supervisors who are getting ready to make the move. They got a script they're working on. They got district. They see District 9. They're working on their whatever, their feature, mm-hmm. because they're looking for a way out. And they don't want to go back to Springfield and work at a restaurant. They like working in the industry, so they want to work on a film. If a few of those people make the move, if 10 people who are visual effects artists now or visual effects supervisors now start making their own feature and pull the crew in from their friends, suddenly there's not going to be that many visual effects people left.
Yeah, that's true.
I see a lot of people trying to figure out a way out of this.
Yeah.
And that's not good for the industry.
I'm
really
thinking
is.
A visual effects themed restaurant. I think that would be good.
Well, yeah, I think that is good. You sort of do a what did we call it? We had an idea for this years ago, actually. It's like a Hard Rock Cafe for nerds.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
But
that's it. Well, you know, I had planned on asking wrapping this whole thing up, I was going to say, what would you want to see happen? And specifically, I was focused on Cameron as, you know, would you want to see him actually make a statement? Like you say in your article, you know, a small statement would cause the press attention to focus on this issue. But it sounds to me like your goals are less on that in the reality. It's more everything we've been talking about. And I appreciate you bringing this all up and really focusing stuff on this issue.
I'd love for Cameron to do that, but here's the thing: everyone in the world knows who Cameron is. Now, name the people from District 9, or even Star Trek. I mean, some people know who JJ is, but everyone knows who Cameron is.
Right.
And so I'd love to see that, but I don't expect it. But I'll tell you what I would like to see: I would like to see the people who win the Oscar for visual effects. And I didn't write this in the article because who cares about them? But we care about them. Say something. If you win the Oscar for visual effects, please take 10 seconds and say something about it because it will have a huge impact. And those guys, there's no excuse. If you're one of the people from District 9 or Avatar or Star Trek who wins this year, say something. That's what I'd like to do. I don't
that's
know
great.
Who it's going to be, but don't you? I mean, that's
no,
what
I
we need.
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree. And I was laughing when I my mind works in evil ways, and I was thinking, hey, it's only $1,000 to get a full page ad in the VES Awards, and it would be nice to have that reprinted right there, wouldn't it? But and we could probably put a collection together. And I thought, you know what? It's not going to accomplish anything. They probably wouldn't even accept it. But I think you've reached more people than would ever see that program.
Well, yeah, but I mean, then you look at it like you. Yeah, I like the way you're thinking, though, Jeff, because honestly, I do. I really like the way you're thinking because the fact is if, you know, a couple hundred people put in $5 each and look, there's a couple hundred people and we can all put in. I've had a bad couple months. I could afford $5.
Yeah, sure.
So
I had thought it through much further than that. I had said, you know, well, if they don't accept it, we'll tell everybody in advance that the money goes to Haiti if they won't accept it.
Yeah, no, but
I'm not going
that
far. I was just making a joke. I think you've reached, like I said, more people than will ever see the program at an award show. So,
but I think it's got to keep going. I think the thing is, it's got to keep going. And I'm trying to figure out strategically the next move for HuffPost if there is one. But I have a feeling if I do another one, they may or may not feature it unless we make some news. So, I mean, what would be nice is somebody at the Oscars saying something or somebody at the VES Awards saying something.
Yeah, VES Awards is actually, there's a hell of a lot more opportunity for a lot of different people who get up there to accept awards to make a comment. So
well,
I'm not
I'll
encouraging you, that, but, you know, if it happens, it happens.
I'll tell you what David Cohen from the Variety told me. He said they would like to cover this issue more. He said he's personally sympathetic.
I know David's been very supportive.
But what he told me was we need news. And the advantage I have at working the Huffington Post is, writing for the Huffington Post for a couple of years now, is I understand the value of news. You can't just write about, like, I'm interested in omelets. You got to write about stuff that's at a bigger level. And so the reason I like what you're suggesting Jeff, is that it's you're thinking newsworthy. Like, the point isn't to get it in the VES thing. It's then to get publicity that you put in the VES thing. So it's like you're thinking the right way. We need to make news. So maybe it's, you know, will visual effects artists stand outside a premiere with signs at some point? Will they, blah, blah, blah? I mean, I can think of 100 ways to do this, but a lot of them involve collective action. And now let's see where people are, you know, do you know your rights? Are you interested in getting a better life for you and your family? Or are you interested in defending the status quo for the studios? That's what it comes down to me. So
that's an awesome place to end, and I appreciate it. And I have a feeling we'll be talking. I know we'll be talking off the podcast, but I wouldn't be surprised if we talk again in the future. So I appreciate this. And I'm really, like I said, I can't express my gratitude, and I'm sure I'm expressing this for a lot of people in your initial article and what I think is going to spin from that. So thank you very much.
And I really appreciate you and all the work you've been doing, and thanks for everything that you do as well.
Tell people where they can find you again, just so they have that.
Well, leestranahan.com is my main website. I also have Film School Bootcamp, which is my training site. We do visual effects supervision classes, and we're going to be doing classes in making your own sci-fi film, making your own horror film. These are real, live, hands-on events. And dreamcareer.info is my online training school.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again.
Thank you, Jeff.
Whether you agree with Lee Strathairn or not, certainly this is an issue that really needs to be discussed, and we really appreciate him taking the time to have such an open and honest discussion with our own Jeff Huser. Coming up in future weeks on the FX podcast, we have some really great interviews with Paul Dubevic, who's up for a technical Oscar, as well as the producers who wrote the Visual Effects Producer book, which is one of the first books we've ever seen on a serious take on the visual effects producing side of the industry. All of that coming up in future weeks here at FX Podcast, which of course comes out regularly, and you can pick it up either through iTunes or at fxguide.com. I'm Mike Seymour. On behalf of Jeff, John, and myself, thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.